From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Biodiversity is a technical term that means something very simple. The plants on our planet form a complex and ever-evolving balance with all of nature, a balance we frankly don't understand. But what we do understand is that the destruction of this diversity can directly threaten our survival as a species. Kenny Ausable is a filmmaker, writer, and environmental entrepreneur. His company, Seeds of Change, is enabling backyard gardeners to reintroduce the vast diversity of vegetables, grains, and fruits which existed at the turn of the century. We'll speak with him and his wife, Nina Simons, about this philosophy and the techniques used on their breeding farm in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'll also speak with Stephen King. Dr. King is the Vice President for Ethnobotany and Conservation at Shaman Pharmaceuticals. We'll talk about their experience in working with shamans and native peoples in tropical forests to identify therapeutic plants and their potential uses. Kenny Ausable has written the book Seeds of Change, The Living Treasure. In it, we find that only 5% of the vegetables, grains, and fruits which were grown 100 years ago are grown today. I asked him why that was and what it meant.
Essentially, what has happened over the course of the 20th century is the diminishing of diversity largely because of commercial agriculture, where their interest is uniformity in crops and crops that have patentability. So according to the National Academy of Sciences, uniformity is the enemy. It's dangerous because just as a banker would recommend a diversified portfolio to you to tell you not to put all of your money into one stock, nature does not favor centralization either. The diversity of life are options for our survival. It's the collective genetic memory, and you want to draw upon that because the only constant in nature is change. And as life changes, which the rate of change is heightening today, including things like global warming, of course, and human intervention. But so from that point of view, you want to maintain the diversity, yet commercial agriculture has telescoped it into a very few number of plants. Basically, there are anywhere from about 30,000 to 80,000 edible food plants, yet today only about 20 plants make up 90% of our diet, and actually three plants make up 60%.
Three plants.
Which
three?
Corn, rice, and wheat.
Wow.
And of those, there are very few varieties of each one that are grown anymore. So that, you know, for example, there are 30,000 kinds of rice alone, yet only 10 account for 75% of all the rice that's grown in Asia today. And this is just very foolish biologically, as well as being very boring from a culinary standpoint.
One example you were giving in the book was the Irish potato famine.
Exactly. And the Irish relied on, after 2 centuries of taking the time to get used to the idea of the potato, the Europeans finally decided they liked it and then grew only one kind. And what happens in nature is a game that we call crops and robbers. Nature is a dynamic balance. It's always pests and plants are co-evolving at the same time. And in that sense, resistance is a moving target. So when you have only one kind of a plant, a bug or a blight of some sort will inevitably find it and ravage it. And that's exactly what happened. 1 million people died in Ireland because of that. And another 1 million had to flee the country to find food. So what the scientists did with their plant breeders at that time, they found a relative of the potato from Latin America where it originated, and they crossbred the resistance back into the potato. So that when we look at the loss of diversity in agriculture, these are the genes of importance that can literally save our lives.
Now, there is Seeds of Change, the book, and Seeds of Change, the company. Tell us about the company and why you named it Seeds of Change.
The company began about 5 years ago and has grown exponentially every year. And it's part of the strategy of the company to engage an army of backyard gardeners to help preserve biodiversity. And what we found was that farmers don't really care about diversity because they really care about monoculture and growing a large amount of one crop. And businesses tend not to care that much about biodiversity, although we hope that that's beginning to change. But gardeners innately really care about diversity. They tend to look over their fence and see something new and different in their neighbor's yard and get really interested in varieties and unusual things. And so we decided it was really important to help educate people and engage people with that innate interest and get them involved with us in helping to preserve biodiversity and restore diversity into the food system. Kenny founded the company about 5 years ago. Kenny, tell us about how you named it.
Well, there's only really one constant in nature, and that is change. Everything is always changing, and adaptability is the key to survival. The genes are essentially the living treasure of options for survival, and we thought, therefore, Seeds of Change would be a perfect name.
How many different seeds do you deal with?
We have two catalogs. Our main one, which is the sort of mainstream catalog, has over 500 varieties, which are what we call winners for backyard gardeners. And then we have a second catalog, which is a bit more esoteric, that's sort of the playground for our research director, who's a maniac seed collector, who has thousands upon thousands in his personal collection, and has about 1,000 that he feels are of great interest to all kinds of gardeners, including very esoteric ones. That's called the Deep Diversity Catalog. And then actually, the company was founded essentially upon a core of these collectors who are plant people who are quite obsessed with seeds. And when I grew up, I used to collect bubblegum cards, and they never stopped, except they, you know, sublimated it into seeds.
We're going to get calls on this, you know. Does he still have his bubblegum cards?
I do. Over 5,000 of them.
Wow. How do you get a seed? I mean, I'm kind of like one of those people that go to the garden center and it already starts out as a little plant, and I don't know where the seeds come from.
Well, people collect them in the wild, for one thing. You can find seeds, of course, in any, you know, living ecosystem, and our collectors are always looking for stuff wherever they go. They carry, you know, plant books with them and identification books and so forth. And then there's a whole sort of underworld of seed traders and collectors that are, many of them, of course, gardeners, and then other people who are simply obsessed with seeds, and they trade a lot. And then there's, of course, a formal network that would be seed banks and, you know, seed collections of either governments or industry or, you know, public collections and so forth.
When we grow out our seeds, though, there is a process that you go through where you bring a plant through to a different level of maturity, so that the seeds actually, it goes past often its fruiting stage to the point where it would naturally send off its seeds and procreate. And all of our seeds are actually certified organically grown, which we felt was terribly important in founding the company as well, because we're really the only company nationally selling only organically grown seeds. And to us, it was very clear that there was a missing link in the chain of organic food production, that how can you really grow an organic food without starting from an organic seed?
Well, I think there's a couple of misconceptions I had. First of all, when I heard organic, I thought, well, it's the same old food, same old vegetables and fruits, but they were grown organically. And then it never occurred to me that there might be a diversity of fruits and vegetables we were looking at, number one, and number two, that the seeds themselves might not be organically produced.
Well, I think you're looking at several different issues, actually, that we address through the company, one of which is how the seeds are actually produced, whether there are chemical pesticides and fertilizers used in their production, and whether they're then coated with chemicals prior to their sale. And then there's another question, which is whether the seeds are hybrid or open-pollinated in nature. And an open-pollinated seed is appreciably different, actually, than a hybrid seed. And I think most of the food that's available commercially at this point in supermarkets and otherwise tends to be grown from hybrid seeds.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Kenny Azabal and Nita Simons, CEO and President, respectively, of Seeds of Change. Kenny is the author of a new book by that same name. Well, let's just take an example. Let's talk tomatoes. Everybody knows about tomatoes, and everybody always talks about grandma's tomato and how different it was. What's the difference between the tomatoes we see normally in the stores and tomatoes we might grow ourselves in our backyards?
Right. Well, when I get a salad in a store that doesn't have an organic tomato or a well-grown one, basically to me it's more like a prop than a food. It looks correct, but you taste it and it has no taste, and we're pretty sure it doesn't have much nutrition to speak of. And what you're looking at is what's called a first-generation hybrid seed that's been bred by agribusiness, and they have a certain set of agendas. They're looking at basically at mechanical harvesting for these tomatoes, so it has to have a tough skin, and they have to ripen at the same time, and they have to be able to be shipped long distances and not spoil during that time and so forth. And then, of course, cosmetic considerations, that they look right. So what they've discovered, I did quite a bit of research on this for the book, that when you breed for these industrial traits, the nutrition actually drops. And when these things are picked too early, it doesn't have any vitamin C, and it usually doesn't have any flavor because of certain carbohydrates that don't have a chance to form. So really you're looking at an industrial food system, not one that's concerned with nutrition and flavor.
The alternative in terms of grandma's tomato would be one that was selected by people for people. And so these varieties really tend, in our own research, to be the most flavorful and the most nutritious. And they're the ones that have been selected by backyard gardeners for the very reasons that we all want to eat a tomato.
Well, how many people are involved in backyard gardening?
It's the largest leisure time activity in the United States, anywhere from 50 to 100 million people.
Not football, not baseball.
Well,
gardening.
You know, we're talking active.
And productive.
Right. Potatoes, not couch potatoes.
Yeah, I see. Well, that's good. Bumper sticker's going to come
but
out
of
it.
In relation to the taste of food, the best testimonial that we ever had came in a letter from somebody that we got last year who had planted a hybrid corn in her garden. And then a couple weeks later, planted one of our open-pollinated Native American corns. And the Seeds of Change corn was far superior. It had very big stalks, big green leaves, was forming wonderful ears, actually was getting ahead of where the hybrid was, until one morning, these two Percheron horses from her neighbor's field broke through her fence, and it leveled all the Seeds of Change corn and didn't touch the hybrid corn. So we consider this to be the ultimate testimonial. Horse sense.
I love it. I love it. Well, you know, I am really struck by when I think about it, it's like what fruit and vegetables and produce in general looks like in the United States. I remember I spent a little over a week on Capri once, and as you walk around the island, there is every house has sort of these uncontrolled gardens around it, and you see tomatoes and cucumbers and zucchinis and everything, every kind of vegetable. And you go into the markets. Everywhere, the vegetables have dents in them and scars, and they're all different colors, but they taste fabulous. Uh-huh. They're wonderful. And then you put a tomato you would find in a normal supermarket next to it, and they look fake.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I had to laugh. I think you were describing one tomato in the catalog, a red calabash tomato, is being downright ugly. I sort of thought of it as the Lyle Lovett of tomatoes.
But with a lot of soul.
With a lot of soul. And but one of the things that did strike me is that we've got hundreds of millions of people to feed, and we can do some growing of produce in our backyards.
Absolutely. And more people, of course, are going to farmers' markets. And we're working now with market gardeners who supply farmers markets for people who don't have their own gardens. But that is available to people even in the cities, is to go to a farmers market and have direct contact with a farmer who is working in his or her fields. And you, in many cases, you can actually go visit those farmers' fields if you want to and pick your own produce. And we believe, I think, at Seeds of Change that it's very important to decentralize our whole food system, and that it's not a sustainable thing to be eating tomatoes from Chile that are imported by air in the winter here. Even if they're organically grown, that's crazy, you know, to fly them 3,000 miles or 6,000 miles up. So I think we need to look at a diversified, decentralized food system.
We were talking earlier about grandma's tomatoes. I noticed reading some of the descriptions. I loved reading your catalog. I just kept going back to it saying, that's interesting. Some were marked as heirlooms. What's an heirloom seed?
An heirloom seed is has been passed down through generations, usually of Europeans. And I'll give you an example of how this is happening right now. We got a letter about 2 years ago from a preacher in Appalachia, in the mountains of Appalachia, with a little packet of bean seeds. And what had happened was one of his elderly parishioners had died, and the family was not interested in this little tiny box of seeds that they found. And he asked, what are these? And they said, oh, she was a gardener, and those were brought over by our relatives 150 years ago from Europe. So the reverend was very moved by this, and they're very beautiful, physically beautiful, these beans. So he saved them and sent them to us. And since that time, he's now sent us 100 different types of corn and beans that he's collected from all over the Appalachian Mountains, because he went around and started asking all of his parishioners, you got any old seeds? And what he actually does now is he goes and he sits in front of Walmart, and he looks for people wearing overalls, and then he asks them if they have any seeds.
He hasn't been arrested yet.
No, but these are the heirlooms. This is the legacy. You know, this is the living treasure. And you have to realize that these seeds are not, quote, natural. Garden seeds are things that have co-evolved only in the linkage with people. People preserve them. People grow them. People have actually created them. They're what are called cultivars. They've been cultivated. You wouldn't find them growing wild in the forest or something. And in fact, it's really the work of geniuses. These are the finest gardeners who've walked the rows over generations of generations, seeing what was really good, what resisted pests, what resisted disease, what had the best nutrition. And it's a living legacy, and that's why we would call it an heirloom.
All of these seeds are like a large database of information, which makes the sort of the expert systems of today sort of pale with how much information is in them. It's a huge genetic database.
Yeah. We find that in developing Seeds of Change, it becomes ever more apparent to us that Seeds of Change is really an information company, that we're not only intent upon spreading the genetic information, but also through our catalog and now the book, really sharing a wealth of information with people about the richness of the world that we live in.
The book has also spawned a PBS documentary that will be out later this spring called Genetic Time Bomb, which goes in depth into these issues. And among other people, they did film with Vice President Gore, who has said that the threat of genetic erosion is the most serious threat to our food security that there is, the loss of diversity in the food system.
My guests today are Kenny Azabal and Nina Simons. They are environmental entrepreneurs, and they are the CEO and president of Seeds of Change. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Yesterday, I was very fortunate to attend the vegetable tasting, which Alice Waters and Charlie Trotter hosted over at Chez Panisse. And I'm pretty savvy when it comes to cooking. I know what the cooking method contributes and what the herb or spice contributes. I was amazed at not only the new tastes I experienced, but the textures I experienced. Everybody was saying, what is this? What is this? One person said, I've refused to eat a beet since I was 4 years old. By golly, that was a beet. How different are these fruits and vegetables?
Well, I think they're substantially different. In some instances, they're different in that they're more flavorful than the varieties that one buys at the market, like the beet that you just described. But in other instances, there was a dish that Charlie Trotter had prepared that was made from wild salsify. And salsify is a root vegetable, akin to a parsnip or a carrot. And he had made this beautiful terrine that was just delicious, made with roast salsify. And no one in the room really had ever tasted salsify before. So it's a very exciting process of realizing that there are so many things out there that you could be enjoying and that are generally nutritious as well as very delicious. So, and as gardeners, you can actually engage in the process from the seed to the table.
How accessible are these seeds? How do we get seeds like this?
Well, they're available through our catalog and also in health food stores and garden centers throughout the country.
You know, what you find with these very fine chefs whom I interviewed for the book was their first criterion for their customers is taste. That's why people come to eat. The fact that it's healthy and nutritious is important to more and more people, but still usually a secondary consideration. And uniformly, the chefs all said that the heirloom vegetables simply are more flavorful, especially if they're grown organically, when there's a marked difference in taste.
Well, that was interesting to me when I looked over those recipes that were in the book from Alice Waters and Charlie Trotter and Mark Miller from the Coyote Cafe. One of the things I thought was interesting is the substitutions that, if you had a real live heirloom vegetable, you could use this, or you could use this, or you could use this. So, Kenny, Nina spoke earlier about a volunteer army to empower conservation. What is that concept?
Our theme at Seeds of Change is what we call backyard biodiversity. And what we're witnessing today is an ecological holocaust with entire ecosystems being taken out in very short periods of time. And the reality is that if these plants are going to be saved, the actual stuff itself, it's only going to happen in gardens, in living gardens, either in people's yards or in botanical gardens. And it was our philosophy that because gardeners really love diversity, and there are so very many of them, that if we were able to be effective in getting the seed stocks and dispersing them more widely, that this could become a mobilization of an entire volunteer army of backyard gardeners practicing backyard biodiversity. And in effect, you're going to see the creation of a green necklace of living gardens all around the world.
So there doesn't have to be an official club, there doesn't have to be a government or an organization, but in fact individuals can contribute to the biodiversity of the planet.
We believe that if the world indeed is going to be saved, it's not going to be done on the weekends. People need to get involved, and lots of people need to get involved. And we believe that it's very important for people to feel empowered and take personal responsibility and just go out and do it. We like to say that nobody in Seeds of Change waited for the bus. We just went and did this because we saw that it had to be done. We didn't wait for a grant or a government or official sanction. And there are many, many people, I think, that share that sentiment.
You know, it's interesting. I have some friends whose family have farmed in the Ventura Valley here in California for a number of generations, and they have many hundreds of acres under cultivation. And when you go and sit at their table, you actually eat the fruits and vegetables that are from their backyard. I'm sure I'll get a call from him. Now, you're working on a new book. Part of the title is Brother, Can You Spare a Paradigm? What's that about?
We do an annual Seeds of Change conference that's called The Bioneers, Practical Solutions for Restoring the Environment. And Brother, Can You Spare a Paradigm? The idea is that these are all people working from a biological paradigm rather than a mechanical one or one of domination of nature. It's more about cooperation with nature. And our research director was waxing poetic with his wife one night, describing the wonderful five kingdoms of nature and the bacteria and the plants and all this stuff. And she stopped him and said, "Why do you call it a kingdom? Because there aren't any kings in nature." And he was speechless, a rare thing. And she said, "What if you just took out the G from kingdom and made it kindom? Because isn't that what biology's about? It's all about relationships." And that's the concept that all of these people are working from. And over the years, I've just been interested in these areas and ended up finding quite a number of people who have actually found real solutions to many of the most pressing environmental problems that we face. So it's not really a technical issue. It's a matter of their approach. And their approach being one that's much more to do with interdependence rather than dependence. And so we've pulled all those folks together for our conference, and now we're going to create a book out of that that will help to point the way towards, we believe, how we could solve about 80% of our environmental problems by the year 2000 with existing technologies and approaches.
Now, I live in a city. Would I be able to, I have a little backyard, would I be able to use seeds?
Absolutely. We find that more and more people are growing vegetables and herbs and flowers in cities, and we're really interested in supporting that work. Obviously, if you have a sunny window, you can grow seeds. You can grow herbs and probably vegetables as well. So there are also, again, in dealing with diversity, there are a large number of varieties that are particularly well adapted to small spaces or to particular conditions like partial shade or, you know, whatever it happens to be. So we find that it's increasingly important for people to have some contact with nature, no matter where you live. I was going to add also, actually, in relation to the Army of Backyard Gardeners, that part of the foundation that the company is built upon is one of sustainable relationship. And it's part of how we approach our business that all of the people we work with, including retailers who sell our seed and backyard gardeners who buy our seed, are, as far as we're concerned, people who are engaging with us to help preserve diversity in a long-term relationship.
You mentioned in your book that in 1989, the National Academy of Science issued a report called Alternative Agriculture, and in it, they call for a national shift to organic farming. Why did they do that?
Well, they actually went out and studied about 7 or 8 farms that were growing organically and compared them against conventional farming methods, and they made several conclusions from that. These farms were actually equally productive. In other words, there was no drop in yields, which has been the conventional sort of bugaboo that if you go organic, your yields will drop in half. And that was found to be not true. The yields were at least the same. And they actually turned out to be more profitable because the market value of organic foods now is superior to that of conventional ones. And the other overriding consideration was, the safety of the food and the fact that they were not polluting the environment. And the reality of chemical agriculture is that it's been disastrous environmentally, as well as being extremely costly and having driven many people out of business. But the food supply has become tainted with poisons, and more than half the states in the country now have an excess of nitrates in our water supply. And agriculture is actually the largest single non-point source polluter of any industry in the United States. So it's a very, very serious problem. And we're, you know, once you begin to factor the environmental costs into the economic equation, the food is no longer cheap.
This also brings us on the other side of the pendulum, swings on the other side of the pendulum to such things as genetically engineered tomatoes. Where does that fit in?
Well, it's probably the most serious issue facing us for the balance of the decade, I think, is going to be the gene revolution. First we had the green revolution, and now it's going to be the green gene revolution. And, you know, the promise of biotechnology was that it would eliminate the need for chemicals and pesticides because they could engineer it into the genetics to resist pests or and so forth. Well, it's not what's happening. Most of the seed companies have been acquired by chemical companies, and half of the field trials currently being carried out on genetically engineered plants are to make the plants able to take more pesticides. So it's very, very serious. They're actually putting pesticide tolerance into the genetics themselves. And you've seen a concentration of all the 12 largest pesticide companies in the world have acquired about 1,000 seed companies over the last 20 years. So this is the forefront of what's going to be happening, and organic food will, I think, you know, be the battleground where much of this takes place.
How long can you preserve a seed with minimal loss of attributes now?
Seed preservation is totally specific to the variety and to the conditions in which it's kept. To give an example, we have one bean that an archaeologist found in an Indian cliff dwelling in the Southwest that was carbon dated as being 1,500 years old. And our research director was able to germinate it and grow it, and we offer it now. So,
the Jurassic Park, agriculturally speaking.
Right. Then again, if you have a carrot seed and you leave it in the light for half an hour, it's gone. So it won't germinate. So, you know, you have to be very, very careful, or in the heat and the light, I should say.
There's a lot of art and science to this.
Right, exactly.
In general, seeds need to be kept in a cool, dry, dark place. And you can maintain their germination longer if they're kept in a freezer, actually. But generally, they will tend to last for 3 to 5 years without a substantial loss in germination.
Now, Kenny, your book is sprinkled with quotes from many people. One quote that struck me became even more interesting when I realized who you were quoting. And if you would, read us that quote and then tell us who you're quoting and tell us what it means to you.
Today it is not enough to say, thou shalt not kill. Ecological thinking assumes, above all, respect and love for all living things. This is where ecological culture comes together with religion. The meaning of life and the unique nature of life is in its diversity. The philosophy of survival is based on the philosophy of diversity. And that's from Mikhail Gorbachev at the Global Forum of Spiritual Leaders last year in Japan. And we believe ultimately that we're not talking just about a technical reason that we should all be concerned about the Irish potato famine and therefore should conserve our genetic diversity. I think we believe it's really a spiritual question, ultimately, that it's about honoring the sacredness of life itself and whether we know whether it has a use or not. It's just all part of life and we should take care of it.
Would you like to add something to that, Nina?
That in my time with Seeds of Change, one of the things that I've learned to really appreciate in a fuller sense is this extraordinary fabric of life that we live in, and appreciating that as the threads become pulled out, the fabric will have a tendency to unravel, and we don't always know which threads are the most important, so it's terribly important that we honor them all and honor the fabric.
Kenny and Nina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guests today have been Kenny Ozebol and Nina Simons from Seeds of Change. Seeds of Change, The Living Treasure, is published by Harper San Francisco, a division of HarperCollins Publishers. It's the subject for the PBS documentary entitled The Genetic Time Bomb, airing in April. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Stephen King is the Vice President for Ethnobotany and Conservation at Shaman Pharmaceuticals. I asked him to describe ethnobotany and its relation to pharmaceuticals.
Ethnobotany is the study of how native people use plants for food, shelter, medicine, and a variety of other purposes. For us, the specific part of ethnobotany is ethnomedicine, how people use plants for medicine. Historically, pharmaceutical companies have utilized plants as sources of pharmaceuticals. In fact, there's about 121 products on the market today that were derived by looking at the use of plants by native peoples. That emphasis shifted in the 60s and 70s more toward genetic engineering and biotechnology with the belief that nature and the knowledge of those people wasn't going to be necessary in the future to develop novel pharmaceuticals and new drugs. That hasn't, in fact, entirely been the case, and there's a great resurgence of interest both in plants and especially in the knowledge of indigenous people, and that's the foundation of our pharmaceutical firm is the knowledge of those people, particularly in the tropics, of how to use plants for medicine.
So the ethno portion is you look at the botany inside ethnic groups?
Correct. The ethno is indigenous peoples, native cultures, and how they use plants.
Now, when we're beseeched to preserve rainforests because they contain plants, which may be key to our survival, you kind of get the impression that these plants belong to all humankind. Now, in contrast, I like the image of indigenous people hiring legal counsel to protect their intellectual property rights. What are the issues regarding indigenous plants, the knowledge of how to use these plants, and transferring that knowledge to mass-produced drugs available to everybody? What are the issues that are involved there?
Well, there's an extraordinary number of issues associated with that wide bit of information you just presented. First of all, I think many of the legal counsels looking at this problem or this issue of how to make certain that the people have this knowledge and use these resources are properly compensated, they see it as a great new boon and also as a major nightmare because it is so complicated. The major issues associated are how to make certain that the plants and that knowledge is properly compensated for. Another associated issue is not just the knowledge of the native people, but that the countries themselves have sovereignty over those genetic resources vis-a-vis the Biodiversity Convention in Rio. Increasingly, countries look at those resources as their patrimony, and the knowledge of the people is also part of that country's collective, if you will, resources. But they often don't view each other as important. In other words, indigenous people don't always identify themselves as part of a country, and the countries don't always see the people themselves as that important and their knowledge, yet they are concerned about the plants. So there's different parties within the countries themselves vying for who should be the proper recipients of protection and compensation. It's extremely complex, and at the same time, it's fairly straightforward. If you acknowledge that the people who have the knowledge should be compensated and then take steps to do that in collaboration with those people, it becomes a bit more straightforward, and that's what we do.
It would be overly simplistic to say Shaman Pharmaceuticals wants to look at plants, ethnobiology, and get what we can there instead of doing sort of synthetic engineering to produce medicines. Because you have a whole orientation, a whole approach to how you work with indigenous peoples. Tell us about that.
Right. We work with indigenous shamans, healers, traditional doctors as colleagues. We send in teams, someone like myself, an ethnobotanist, and a medical doctor, Western trained. We say that it takes two of us to equal one of them. We spend time with those individuals as colleagues, discussing the use of plants for treatment of the specific diseases we're interested in. And we also provide health care simultaneously where and when appropriate in a culturally sensitive fashion. So, in fact, we sort of break the paradigm that their knowledge is very anecdotal and not likely to be very important. In fact, we have found and continue to find that there's a great deal of pharmacological basis for the use of plants by these people. So it's more of a colleague-to-colleague relationship. And you're right, that's dissimilar to most approaches.
Give us an example. I mean, they don't speak English, yeah.
Right, well, most of our people are multilingual. I speak Spanish. Everybody that goes in the field is usually multilingual and say the lingua franca, French, Spanish, whatever they speak. And then we often work with local counterparts who are fluent in the local language. You also find that most of these people, some of them do speak the lingua franca of the region, say, be it Portuguese or Spanish or French or English, depending upon the region. So there is we can communicate directly to the lingua franca. With the more detailed information, we often work with local counterparts who are multilingual in those Indian languages, and that enables us to actually get to even the more subtle levels of information.
Well, give us an example of one of your experiences.
Well, I'd be traveling, say, to the Ecuadorian Amazon and take a couple days to get even to the launching point where we would then leave in a small, say, Cessna and go to a remote village. In advance of arrival, we've had permission asked, explained who we are, what we hope to do with someone who has worked with those people for a long period of time. And we will get, when that permission has been granted, we will go there, fly in, bring with us our physician and botanist. In a specific case, we made a number of agreements for immediate reciprocity. So we make arrangements for a long-term return of compensation should we develop a product, but we also say that period of time for drug development can be up to 10 years, faster in our case. We certainly plan, but that's way too long to wait for a compensation or reciprocity to take place. So we do it right then. That, in this case, it was providing the lengthening of an air strep, some long-term medical care on regular intervals for diseases they couldn't cope with, a training program for local people to work with the elder shaman as an apprentice. And these are not things that we said, would you like to have this done? These are things in the dialogue which were told to us as necessities for the village. And in every place we work, that's generally the case.
Okay, so you flew in the Cessna, and you have some interchange with the shaman. Are you looking at preparations? Tell us.
Sure. We have some methodologies that involve describing specific illnesses, going off into the forest with a healer or a shaman, basically wandering around sometime for an entire day at a time, discussing disease cases using photographs and other tools that we've created, to have discussions, identify plants in the field, collect them, come back to the village, dry them, catalog them, have further discussions with other individuals, elder women, variety of people that have knowledge about the use of plants for healing, keep processing that material and continue that process I just described virtually every day that we're there, going out in the forest with the healers, discussing the cases, the kind of diseases that we're working on, which are antivirals, antifungals, and sedatives and analgesics and plants for diabetes. Of course, in the tropics, there's insects, infectious diseases, snakes, all those kind of things. We get problems from time to time in the field. Last trip I was on in Papua New Guinea, the physician I was with, Tom Carlson, ran into a plant that causes a rather nasty dermatitis reaction. His arm is covered in really ugly blisters, and one of the local healers treated him for that with a plant that gave him quite a bit of relief, and one that, of course, we've subsequently been analyzing. The jury's not out yet, but we certainly do learn things in ways that we hadn't anticipated as well.
So you weren't looking, but he developed this reaction.
Well, I mean, yeah, he would love to have avoided that reaction. It was a 3-week, very painful, unpleasant condition, but the local healer treated him.
So they might not have found that otherwise.
Absolutely.
So you have to give your whole body to Shaman Pharmaceuticals.
Occasionally, your body, your mind, and your soul.
That's great. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Stephen King. He is the Vice President of Ethnobotany and Conservation for Shaman Pharmaceuticals. Now, it's one thing to collect some plants for a small populace. There's got to be a lot of difficulties in moving that to, first of all, producing a lot more of the plants and delivering it to a mass market.
Sure. Well, the important thing to remember is we're not an herbal medicine company. We're looking for pure molecules that can act as therapeutic agents. What that means is we have to identify an individual agent from the plant that is acting to create the therapeutic effect. Once that's done, we then make the assessment as to whether that individual molecule, which can be approved by the FDA as a new drug if all the efficacy and safety is in place, can be synthesized in a laboratory, in which case the concern you just mentioned is moot. You have to work out the scale-up and all that to make large quantities here in South San Francisco, wherever. Or if the molecule is so complicated that it has to be supplied from nature. What we do at the very beginning of our process of evaluating potential plant candidates is look at the diversity, abundance, long-term sustainability of any given plant resource that we may work with. What that means is in the case of our lead antiviral products, is we were able to assure ourselves, even before we assured the FDA, our investors, anybody else, that we could produce large enough quantities to supply the kind of market that we know exists for the type of therapy we want to develop. Now, the best-known case where that wasn't adequately done would be the case of Taxol for ovarian cancer here in the temperate regions of the Northwest. there was a great deal of problem with supply, and that aspect hadn't been addressed during the development phase of the drug. We're the opposite approach. We do it side by side as we're evaluating all the other components. So when I say to you, we'll be able to supply you with adequate quantities in a fashion that is both sustainable and economically useful to the local country counterparts, I can say that with the knowledge of the studies that we've conducted in those countries. And at times that's a lengthy and costly process, but it's as important as the rest of the work that we do, so that we can say to anyone that asks that question, don't worry, we wouldn't do it unless we were convinced that it will work both for us and the countries we work in.
It would be more economically viable for you then to isolate the molecule that's really doing it and produce it synthetically than to have to go and grow these plants?
Actually, a very popular misconception. By no means. It's fully a matter of economics. Depends on the kind of molecule that it is. We've seen, we believe that about 50% of our cases, it would be more economically viable to synthesize it in a laboratory. The point is more that the nature of the molecule dictates that, not our business policies or economics. If we can do it in a lab, we would, but if we know that it can't be done, and we have examined the growth potential, the ecology, distribution, the biology of it, then it becomes equally as manageable, so it's not a concern. It is a popular misconception, though, that, oh, well, of course, these things will be brought back to a laboratory, and never more will the country or the people be involved in the process. In fact, of the 121 pharmaceuticals derived from plants and native knowledge on the market, fully 90% of those are still produced from raw material, either cultivated or wild harvested. So it's a function of the dynamics of the molecule more than somebody's a priori decision.
You know what this reminds me of? I remember when I worked for NASA, and I happened to also be privy to a lot of secure information, and my friends would all come up to me and say, well, we all know you can do fill in the blank. And I'd know we were nowhere near able to do this. So in the same regard, it's almost as if I can go and push a button or submit a piece of paper to a machine, and it's going to generate this synthetic material.
Right.
It's
right.
Not so.
By no means. It's much more complicated. Really, it's an interweaving of the most modern technology and ancient wisdom and ancient knowledge, and that's the power of our approach and the exciting part of it as well. I think we as a culture and society have come to the point to realize that there's a great deal that we need to and still can learn by integrating those great advances, because those people and their knowledge is as sophisticated in many ways as perhaps some of our most powerful equipment in a laboratory. And that's sort of us in a nutshell.
Now, you've talked about some initial recompense just for simply visiting and sharing initial knowledge independent of where it might go. Tell us about all the other levels of compensation.
Sure. I have to draw the distinction. First, we as a company focus on biocultural diversity, so not just biological diversity, but cultural diversity, and that's what that term means. We have a commitment as a company and have had from the outset to significantly contribute to the conservation of that biocultural diversity in the countries in which we work. One of the first things that was done when the company was formed was to create a nonprofit conservation organization called the Healing Forest Conservancy. That organization is dedicated to providing the compensation when there is a product on the market. Until that happens, the company, Shaman, is assuming our direct obligation to provide short and medium-term reciprocity for the activities. In other words, if we work in 30 countries, we will, along the way, have been providing reciprocity at various steps rather than someday when there's a product you will be recipients. We've further changed the dynamics of these arrangements by instituting our policy that all the countries we work with will be recipients of those returns of compensation upon the first and every product. So we bring everybody into a loop, an involvement, so that the country that we worked with last year would benefit just as the country we worked with 5 years ago and that product and every other product. So they become part of that collective pool of beneficiaries when we have a product.
So there isn't a lucky country.
Correct.
And
correct.
The next guy over
correct.
Loses. So in a way, you're rewarding all of the indigenous peoples together.
Correct. And that's somewhat of a paradigm shift. In fact, that's some of the conflicts that are taking place as people try and sort out these complicated issues. Our legal system suggests that only one individual should be the recipient for something like this. When you say that perhaps an entire nation or entire culture are the repositories of that knowledge, that shifts the way these things are done. We aren't saying that as a company because we think all by ourselves this is the way to go. This is what we're told by the groups that we work with. This is a collective knowledge, and we want to see these benefits and reciprocity and compensation go to the cultures, not to an individual or one small community.
Pharmaceutical firms invest heavily in R&D, and when they come up with a compound that works, they patent it and enjoy the economic protection that, that such patents reap. Is any of this patentable?
It's the foundation also of our operation, like any pharmaceutical company. It's all patentable. We, as I mentioned, search for and isolate pure active molecules that have to be novel for us to get a patent on a new composition of matter. So everything that we begin to develop, not only is it patentable, but is patented by us. The process has begun, and we've had several patents issue. We, as a pharmaceutical company, you know, like any other, couldn't do this if that wasn't the case. You can't patent a plant, say, except in the case perhaps of agricultural varieties, but you can't patent a tree that's medicinal. You can patent a compound within it if you find novel activity and a novel structure in our business.
So how much protection does that give you for how long?
17 years, as in any other patent for this industry.
At that time, can someone else pick this up and not pay for any intellectual property rights?
At the expiration date of the patent, generic companies, virtually anybody that is able to do so could conceivably try and produce a competitive product, yeah. As you know, in our industry, it's generally the strategy is to develop advanced, enhanced, and new variations that are novel enough to get new patents and so on. But yes, it could go into the public domain.
So the relationship that you have with the governments and the cultures, that covers the fact that beyond the patent process, you have no more control over its production and manufacture.
After those 17 years, for that particular molecule, yes.
In terms of the drugs themselves, what is your sense of what we're going to get out of this endeavor, from the plant life to whatever?
We have two drugs in human clinical trials right now, one for herpes and one for respiratory syncytial virus, a childhood flu. We have several others that are being worked on furiously in the preclinical stage. We're looking at the emergence and evolution of new pathogens, new viruses, resistant TB. It's a firm conviction of most of us in the company, as well as many other scientists, that there's a tremendous amount of untapped biocultural and chemical diversity that could provide solutions to current diseases for which there is no therapy, and those that are in the process of evolving now, such as hantavirus and others. The process of disease is no more static than any other. We will see more diseases, and we will need more therapy. So we see this as a vital route to meet some of those challenges.
My guest today is Dr. Stephen King. He is an ethnobotanist and previously was a research associate for the Committee on Managing Global Genetic Resources at the National Academy of Sciences. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Where are you looking in the world today?
All the tropical countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. We've been in about 25 countries in the past 4 years. There's about 110 countries. We make return visits to some groups, so we've been back and forth. These are countries in the tropics of Asia, Africa, and Latin America: Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Nigeria, Thailand, New Papua New Guinea. Out of those 110, we're working at them little by little.
Is there any international trade barriers to doing things like this?
The Earth Summit that took place in Rio in 1992, one of the outcomes of those discussions was a biodiversity convention, which our president at the time shamefully decided not to sign, but subsequently the current administration is going to become a party to ratify. That requires that contracts and agreements be made with countries for this type of activity. These are things that we have been doing from the outset. So those may be barriers to people that haven't been operating in that fashion. To us, they are just verification that this is how you need to do business in the year 2000 and beyond.
One area that I was reading about is creating sustainable, natural drug supply industries in tropical countries.
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, a lot of hard work. It requires, first you have to have a product that looks promising, as in the case of our lead antivirals. Then you have to find out whether you can do it synthetically, as we spoke about. And in the case of this product, it has to be sourced from the wild. You have to do research on the ecology, reproductive biology, natural distribution, density, harvest methods. Then you have to look at the socioeconomic factors associated with how those materials can be harvested, transported, and so on. Then you have to create basic management plans as required by government agencies to say, we anticipate requiring X tons of material, as the case may be, and here's how we are going to manage those resources so that that can be acquired. That means the planting, harvesting, long-term studies. It requires integrating a lot of natural sciences along with socioeconomic issues and then making plans.
I know Shaman Pharmaceuticals is fairly new, and you've been in many planning stages right now. Are any of those industries set up so far?
Absolutely. We have been working really almost from the first year with several large groups and government agencies to produce large volumes for our lead antiviral product. We couldn't raise the funds and go into the clinic if we didn't know we had years and years worth of material, which we have now. So those are ongoing. When you have the product on the market, the quantities required are much larger, but we have long-term sustainable programs in place both with indigenous and local people in two countries and two other ones in which they're not in the planning stages, they're being carried out at this time.
Well, tell us about this.
Sure. These involve indigenous federations in one case who met after a year or so of discussions and decided that they would be happy to supply our company with a certain amount of material on a sustainable basis as long as we met certain criteria, and both parties imposed those criteria. Those people...
Can you name any names?
Sure. These are the Aguruna...
That's good. Colorful.
The Aguruna Indians of Peru are the federation with whom we've been working with on this, in that particular part of that country. We have other agreements in process with the Ishanaka Indians of Peru. We have the similar situations working with the Cofan Indians of Colombia. We have similar arrangements working with local indigenous people in the Iquitos area of Peru. So we're spread out all over the place, and that's part of the strategy. You don't depend on any one place, and you also make sure that the impact is not in any one area.
The governments that are participating, what kind of compensation would they expect to get?
Well, theirs is at least in two parts. The first part, as we develop these sustainable industries for long-term supply, we pour a lot of resources in to develop that. And most countries are looking for value-added, increased abilities to bring resources into their country. So they consider that an asset that we will come in and do that, which we've been doing in several places and continue to do. That's a form of immediate sort of sustainable long-term supply. In terms of the outright compensation on a product, we don't make a distinction between the indigenous people and the governments. By that, I mean both parties will be compensated. And the way we do that is to put a portion of the product profits back through the Healing Forest Conservancy, the separate nonprofit, and that goes from there to all the countries we work with. That's both government agencies, indigenous peoples, their federations as well, who participated.
Have there been indigenous people who simply refused to talk to you?
We've had indigenous people. We feel strongly that we have to respect any of that kind of feeling. If they don't want to share certain information or just don't want to talk to us at all, we don't just drop out of San Francisco in helicopters and show up. We do a lot of groundwork so that before we go someplace, for the most part, people have already been explained, and we talk to them when we get there, and so that we don't waste their time or ours to go there. There have been some cases where a group has said we'd prefer not to become involved in X project at this time, and we have honored those requests and completely, basically, left. That's sort of not very common, but sure.
Basically, they've wanted to cooperate.
When we've taken the time in advance to ask permission, go through the steps as you would to go to your house. Basically, I'd like to come talk to you, blah, 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 and explain what my goals are. Usually that works.
Is that insurance salesman?
Right, yeah, knocking at the door. So we have had people say, no, we'd rather not be involved at this time, which we fully respect, which is fine.
What are their fears? Why wouldn't they want to be involved?
There's been at least 500 years of serious exploitation, say, in this hemisphere, certainly alone, from a variety of organizations, all the way from business to even religious organizations, that sort of thing. So they've had not a really tremendous experience in terms of their cultural rights, their land rights, their physical rights, and their physical well-being and safety. Even well-meaning U.S. and international development organizations have wreaked havoc unintentionally while trying to do good. And that's often what we get told is, for 25 years now, we've been involved with this program and that program, and the net result has been that we haven't gained, in some cases, been to our detriment. So we're just not interested right now in external involvements because they don't seem to work. Now, we had one group that said to us, look, if you're in a hurry, a native group, then go away, because things that happen fast tend to have negative impact on us. We said, no problem. We started going slow. We weren't in a big, big hurry. But a year and a half later, we were moving at a stepwise fashion, very controlled fashion. They came back to us and said, if you guys aren't going to do something, we just want you to get lost because this is going on too long. So it's a delicate dance of what do you want and how do you want it and when.
Is there any difference botanically between the tropical zones of Asia and Africa and South America?
Absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of botanical diversity. And most countries have plant species which occur no place else, for starters. Those are obviously unique. There are plant relationships of families of species between Africa and South America and parts of Southeast Asia that have to do with the evolution of the Earth as a global ecosystem. But there's a tremendous amount of botanical diversity that's unique to the regions and countries. So there's a lot of difference. And the cultures, 1,500 minimum distinct indigenous cultures, and that's at a very gross level definition. As you get more discrete, you can give yourself quite a bit more. So you combine that tremendous biological diversity with the extraordinary human cultural diversity, and then throw in several millennia of time for coevolution, and that's the basis of the plant-human diversity that we think is a highly untapped source.
What percentage of the indigenous people do you figure you've talked to so far?
We're a 4-year-old company. We have 100 people now. We've worked with, I think, about 70 different cultural groups at this time. So, and that means going back, too. As we go back, relationships...
Establishing a relationship.
Yeah, and relationships grow, and people are even more inclined to help us learn more about what we want to learn.
Well, during that time, have you changed any perspectives or learned anything about the indigenous peoples?
Well, actually, I came to this all the way around. I spent a year living with an indigenous tribe in the Peruvian Amazon long before I ever got involved in a pharmaceutical company. Most of the scientific field research people that do the work are the same. They don't come from industry. What I've learned the most about is the pharmaceutical industry and how that industry does its business. Regarding indigenous people, what I continue to learn and have learned a while ago is that if you are interested in their well-being and welfare and concerned about it, there's no mystery to understanding what their concerns, needs, and goals are. You simply ask them. I think what I've learned most in my work in Washington, D.C., and New York, and here is that people don't ask. It's very simple. You have dialogues with people. What are your needs? What are your problems? The same ones keep coming up over and over again. Access to land, land title, health care, the same thing you or I have for our children and family. I keep learning that those have been not honored or acknowledged enough historically and still aren't in many cases. So we're endeavoring to create new drugs and have a business while doing that at the same time.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. My guest today has been Dr. Stephen King, formerly the chief botanist for Latin America with the Nature Conservancy. He is currently vice president of ethnobotany and conservation for Shaman Pharmaceuticals. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.